The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, this is a little bit of my mind because of going off on retreat. A month-long retreat is a big deal for someone to do. It's very different from what how people normally would live. The people who are retreatants will spend the month in silence for the greater part of the time, and which is that is an unusual thing to do, and will be involved in mindfulness practice much of the day. And so it's a very different from how people usually live their lives, and it's a challenge to business as usual. And so it's often people are sometimes quite challenged, people who are used to always being in social conversations, or used to always having the television on, or used to always working or checking their emails. There's no email contact when you're there. You kind of sever all the electronic connections. And so it's very different. And that difference is set up so that hopefully people can see themselves and see their world in a new way. And Buddhism is meant to be a challenge to all of us, to challenge us to kind of break out of the usual ways in which we think about ourselves in the world and hopefully see things in a different way. And so hopefully people who go on a month-long retreat, people who do Buddhism, are at least open to the possibility that there are other ways of seeing their life than the ones they currently have, and other ways of seeing themselves. And that includes other ways of seeing their problems. A few of you have problems, right? Only a few. And and usually when there's a problem, there's often unexamined assumptions behind having a problem. There's assumptions about what's important and not important, what needs to happen and not happen. Assumptions about what it means to be a human being, what it means to be me, and what I need to do to be safe, to be accomplished, to get what I want. And unexamined assumption about what life is about to begin with. And so Buddhism is a kind of a mirror, it's meant to be a mirror, where we use the mindfulness to begin examining how is it that we understand ourselves in the world. And are there other ways of understanding it that might be more helpful for us than the ones that we have currently? And if Buddhism is not meant to only, to be a comfort. Some people will come to spiritual teachings because they feel stressed, they feel challenged by life, and they would like to have something comforting to be taught. And that's nice. But in addition to when Buddhism is comforting, Buddhism is also meant to challenge us. And one of the things that challenges us is in our perceptions of how things are. And the teachings on impermanence are not meant to be just teachings, so like impermanence is a good idea to believe in impermanence, but it's really meant to, as a mirror or as a way to look at what do we really believe about life, and to dislodge some of the delusions around permanence. Buddhism has stressed down through the centuries, many different Buddhist traditions, that many people live their lives based on certain, what's often called distorted perceptions. Or it's literally, the translation would be upside down perceptions. We can call them delusions, perhaps. Like one of the delusions is the delusion of permanence. And this is a label I label to myself often. I say, Gil, you just succumb to the delusion of permanence. So, for example, a delusion of permanence would be that I'm having a difficult time at home with my kids, and I'm feeling kind of challenged. And I don't think this way kind of like consciously, but I'm kind of operating kind of emotionally or subliminally, uh-oh, this is it. We're going to have this kind of family life for the rest of my life. You know, and if you ask me if I believe that, I say no, I don't believe it, but there's kind of like this emotional relationship of what's going on, like oh this is it. And it showed to me very dramatically many years ago now, when we were having a difficult time with my older son one day, and it was quite challenging, and my wife looked up at me, we were all kind of around, and she looked up at me and she said, he was quite small, I don't know, and she said, we're having one of those kinds of days. And her saying that popped the bubble of permanence for me. Oh, it's just one of those days. When people go on retreats, especially long retreats, it's really easy to succumb to the delusion of permanence. The first day, some good majority of the people, the first day or two, get really tired, and the mind is really scattered, agitated. And it's relatively common for a high percentage of those people to come to the conclusion, my retreat is shot. This is it. It's hopeless. I'll always be tired. My mind's always going to be agitated and busy. And you know, they're not thinking that way consciously, but again, there's kind of this kind of the emotional relationship to it. You know, uh-oh, this is it. As opposed to, oh, I'm just having one of those kinds of days. I'm having a tired day. And on retreat, it's kind of nice for some people because the first day maybe is tired. The second day, perhaps they're feeling kind of alert and starting to feel kind of calm, and that's nice. The third day, the underlying conflicts, unresolved conflicts in their life show themselves, and it's just like hell. And then the fourth day, those conflicts have kind of receded, and it's blissfully peaceful. And they're about to tell all their friends, you know, how they should all come and become Buddhists and be on retreats, and this is like the way of the future, this is it, they've arrived. Until the fifth day. And the fifth day, you know, they face their, you know, some demon, you know, their childhood, I don't know what. And then, uh-oh, you know, I'm out of here. This Buddhism stuff stinks. Buddhism doesn't make any sense. You know, and have sit here all day with all this terrible stuff, just you know, it's sadistic. And why should I do this the rest of my life? And then comes the sixth day. And at some point, it dawns on a person, wait a minute, it's always changing. And that insight, it's changing, can loosen up the grip of this emotional relationship to things as if they're permanent. And so then, the next time you go on retreat, and the first day is tired, oh, I know this. It doesn't feel so comfortable to be tired, but this is going to pass. This is what happens in the first day. The second day, when it gets a little calm, oh, I know this. This will pass too. The third day, when all the kind of unresolved conflicts appears, oh, I know this. This is just third day phenomena. This will pass too. And with that kind of insight or understanding, the person then begins to hold those experiences more lightly. Before that, like the first time, we hold it as if this is it, assign a lot of meaning and value, define ourselves by it, and it's very intense. And there's an alternative way of relating to it. We can lighten up and hold it lightly. And that insight, oh, it's not permanent, this too will change, can help a lot to make it lighter and easier to be with. If you do it many times, and you see change happening very fast, then the lighter and lighter a person will hold things. And this ability to shift, to hold things more lightly, as opposed to having different things to hold, is a very significant thing to do. Many people want to hold different things. They want to hold their calm, they want to not hold their conflicts. But the fact that we can hold it lightly is a radically different thing. And the insight into impermanence or change is one of those insights that helps us to hold things more lightly. There's a whole class of things is when we think this is it forever, that it's going to cause some kind of difficulty for us, some suffering. So one of the upside-down thinking that Buddhism talks about is the upside-down thinking of what it attributes to permanence or constancy to things which are not so constant. Now the insight that life is impermanent is a kind of a universal insight. You don't need Buddhists to tell you that. Things are often changing. But Buddhism kind of specializes on this insight of impermanence. It makes a big deal of it. Not because we're supposed to see it in the ordinary things of our life. We are. Like the coming and goings of states of mind on a retreat. But to really kind of begin looking at the more subtle workings of the mind and the subtle ways in which there's delusions of permanence attributed to things, and the more subtle ways in which we can begin appreciating how things are inconstant or changing all the time. I lived in Tennessee for a while, and there was a saying in Tennessee that if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes. So that kind of, when things change that fast, then you have a lighter relationship to it. Like when I was in Hawaii, when I moved to Hawaii, and we had this torrential downpours. When I first got there, I ran for cover. And I very quickly learned that in Hawaii, you don't have to do that. Because it doesn't rain for that long, and then the sun comes out and dries you out. And so it's like, so what if it rains? How quickly do things change is a very interesting question. And what the Buddhist suggests is that things are changing much more frequently than we usually realize. So I'll get to that again in a little bit. So in Buddhism, there are three different levels of perceiving impermanence, understanding impermanence. The first level is at the ordinary level that everybody can see. You don't have to be a practitioner or a meditator to see it. And that level of ordinary impermanence has many different... You can see it in the big scope of life. You can see it in details of our life. Sometimes it comes and it's very difficult because we want things to be a certain way. They're nice things. And then suddenly they change and they weren't expected. Suddenly you take a shower and you feel a lump in your breast. And then your whole life changes radically. Or you're driving on the road and everything is fine and someone rear-ends your car and your life has changed radically. Or like my friend Rana, who went to the beach one day with only her driver's license, car, and keys, and came home to find her house had burned down in the Oakland fire. And the house also had her office. So everything she had, except for the key, her driver's license, and her beach towel, her car. You know, just from one day to the next, 1 hour to the next, it's gone. And those kinds of radical encounters with change, that life as we usually expect it to be, disappears or it changes or is challenged, it's challenging for everybody. You don't have to be a Buddhist to be challenged by it. But there's often, not only is there loss in change, it can be loss, but there's also opportunity. There can be gain. If there was no impermanence, things didn't change, then there would be no possibility for something new to happen. And sometimes, when things happen dramatically, big change happens, it's an unprecedented opportunity for us to look at what we were believing, what we were clinging to, and what our priorities are in our life. And I've known lots and lots of people who've had major challenges because of how things change. And they were painful and challenging initially. But in retrospect, after some years, they looked back and said, that was unfortunate in many ways, but I've really changed for the better because of this. This was really, in some ways, I wish that didn't happen, but it was really, if that didn't happen, I would still be mired and stuck in all ways of living. Sometimes people have very powerful identities they hold on to. Like some people, their sense of identity might be around being athletic and being able to do wonderful athletic things. But what they don't see is how tight that identity is, how hard and fast that is, and how people might be defending it, building it up, your sense of security and and status in the world, sense of being a worthwhile person in the world, how you want other people to see you and relate to you, is all centered around being athletic. And then there's a car accident, and so much for the athleticism. And it's very difficult and very challenging. It can challenge, to be challenged in a person's identity, self-identity, is one of the most challenging things to be challenged in. But then after a while, a person might see, wait a minute, that didn't really serve me. And it's unfortunate that I have now this injury, that I can't do my sports, but it's opened my life up to look at myself and life in a whole different way. I'm not relating to my life only through my athletic ability and being competitive. But now I'm paying attention to all those people that came forward to help me. And there was so much heartfeltness where I realized, you know, I didn't want to live my life competitively. There's a whole other way of living. So sometimes the difficult changes can be seen also as opportunities. And if we only look at what's lost, then we are shortchanging ourselves, because sometimes it's useful to go look, in addition to what we've lost, what can be gained. And one of the variations of the delusion of permanence is a delusion that this pain, this loss, is permanent. This is only a bad thing that happened. That is only bad is a delusion of permanence. There's other things that can come from it as well. So just that, hopefully, is a challenge to be open to look in new ways, to not succumb, not depend on the automatic perceptions, interpretations, and meanings of events, but as we see change and as things are lost and gained, to question it and look at it and see the other perspectives in which to understand this. One of the advantages of change, Buddhism says that everything's always changing. It also says that things don't change randomly. It's not just chaotic out there. Karma isn't playing dice. So we can participate in change, and within some reason, we can shape how certain things can change. And so the question is, what is the useful things, what kind of change are useful for us to undertake? To undertake some change sets us up for failure, for difficulty. Some change sets us up for potential difficulties. If all our well-being is dependent on the size of our bank account, that's really the foundation of our sense of security, well-being in life, you might be lucky to get to death with your bank account intact. But there are people who can have their bank account disappear from one day to the next. And if all their eggs were in that basket, it's going to be kind of hard. But if there are other baskets, if there are other things which are important, then other things that are seen as being valuable, then the bank account might not have the same kind of tight, we might not have the same tight grip around it. It might be easier to let go of it. So to cultivate, to realize that there are other places of happiness, other pursuits that are interesting to develop and cultivate besides a bank account, is to take charge of change. To realize that it's not just about things, but it's also about the qualities and capacities of our mind, of our heart. And to realize, you know, I don't have to kind of, my well-being, the state of my mind, my heart, I don't have to let it be at the whim, the victim of causes and conditions. I don't have to let the changing or non-changing circumstances of life dictate how I feel. I can be involved in a process of change where I change myself in such a way that I have an inner stability, inner calm, an inner patience, an inner joy, love, so that those are the defaults, or those are the supports as I go through this life. They're like the keel, or what's it called? The weight in the bottom of the sailboat. It's called the keel, something else. The ballast. So part of what Buddhism says in this world of impermanence, it's really important to cultivate ballast, to cultivate, to take some responsibility for how our mind or heart can be changed, and to begin changing it. I was very impressed, and the first Buddhist book I read was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And Suzuki Roshi, the author, says something like, if you only start doing a spiritual practice when there's a crisis, you might not be ready. But if you start when there's not a crisis, then you might build up the inner strength, the stability, the capacities that prepare you for when things become really difficult. So the world of impermanence and change is a very important one, because it allows us to, encourages us, I would say, in Buddhism, to take some responsibility for how things change and help create the change that is meaningful and valuable and supportive of us. At the same time, realizing that there's no guarantee that anything can be the way, can be permanent. Inner calm, stability, love, bliss, joy, those are also also belong to the world of change and impermanence. Meaning we can't guarantee that those are always going to be there. So Buddhism encourages us not to put all our eggs in the basket of particular states of mind. It isn't about cultivating some blissful, perfect state of mind. If we have that state of mind, then everything will be fine. States of mind, there's no guarantee that those can stay as well. So what Buddhism emphasizes is that there is one particular change that can be more constant. And one of the forms of constancy, things that are more permanent, is the absence of things. Once something is absent, certain things are absent, they don't come back, right? So, for example, I mean, maybe this should be a terrible example, wrong, but if I cut off my hand, you know, am I going to say that the absence of the hand is impermanent? That's it, right? That's permanent. It's not a thing. Only things are impermanent. The absence is not a thing. But when some things have been shed, they don't have to come back. And so what Buddhism points to is the possibility of shedding certain forms of clinging, certain ways of relating to the world, which lead to suffering. So in terms of, do we hold on to things tightly? Do we hold on to things lightly? Or do we give up holding it entirely? So in that kind of example, you know, I can hold on to the bell, and if I can hold it tightly, and then I can hold it lightly, still doesn't do very much. I could not grab it at all. I'm still holding it, but I give up grabbing. If I give up grabbing once and for all, but I hold it with an open hand, so the bell rests in the palm of my hand. But then that's a great sound. And I grab for that and I destroy the sound. So the tendency to grab versus to hold lightly or to hold openly, Buddhism says, is something that you can let go of, see through. And once that's when certain tendencies to grab are let go of well enough, thoroughly enough, then it's more constant. It doesn't have to come back. And that's a kind of, a radical teaching that Buddhism has to offer. And then the question is, how do we realize that capacity to let go? If we can't hold on to things in the world that they guarantee us well-being, and if we can't really hold on to states of mind, even spiritual states of mind, if there's nothing we can really hold and grip onto, that's going to do it for us, then is the alternative. The alternative is to let go of the grip. And what does it take to let go of the grip? There are many things that can support that, make that happen. In Vipassana practice, the mindfulness practice that we do here, one of the vehicles, one of the roads for doing that is to develop the mindfulness strong enough that we don't just see impermanence in the ordinary way that anybody can see, but we start seeing it moment to moment. We start seeing it in the moment-to-moment arising and passing of phenomena. So, for example, I might think that for the time being, my car is mine permanently until it dies or something, you know, probably for the next, it's probably reasonable to guess I'll have my car for the next week. I hope so I can get to the retreat. And so the thought, my car has some idea of permanence in it, temporary permanence. But the thought, this is my car, is impermanent. I'll have that thought, my car, and it might be fleeting for a moment. I might not think the rest of the day the thought, this is my car, until something might happen. But that thought, my car, is quite fleeting. But I might relate to my car as if it's permanent, even though the thought, it's my car, is fleeting. The thought, I am Gil, or I am whatever, it points to some idea of permanence. My name is Gil, that's who I am, probably the rest of my life. Some constancy there. But having a thought, I am Gil, that's a very fleeting thought. I can guarantee you, I'm not going around all day constantly like a broken record saying, I'm Gil, I'm Gil, I'm Gil. You know, it doesn't hardly ever occurs to me until someone asks me, what's your name? That's quite fleeting. The thought, so that the person you're having a major life conflict with, that person might be a little bit too permanent in your life. But the thought that you have about that person, that arises, it's there for a few moments, and then you think about what should I have for dinner. And then a few moments later you think about that person again. And then the telephone rings, and you go see who it is, and then you come back, what was I thinking? And then, oh, that person, that person. And then, you know, that next thought is, I got to go pee. And if you really pay careful attention to what goes on in the mind moment to moment, there isn't a constant holding to thinking about that difficult person. There's a lot of arising and passing of different thoughts moment by moment. So what? The person's not changing as fast. But how we construct our world, the world that we understand, that we live in, is constructed and made by these fleeting impressions that come in and out, that arise and pass, these fleeting interpretations, assumptions, ideas, thoughts we tell ourselves, images we have. And if we can see how fleeting that is and rise and pass, it can sometimes change the way in which we choose to relate to all this. Because we don't really cling to the thoughts of the conflict. I mean, we don't really cling to the conflict. We cling to the thoughts about it, the ideas. I can guarantee you, I'm not clinging to my car when I say, this is my car. Because, you know, and then, you know, I grab onto it. I'm clinging to the idea of my car, the concept, the thoughts I have to it. So, for example, like I like to say here, if this evening we all left in different shoes than we came with, our shoes wouldn't care. What cares is our thoughts and ideas about my shoes. So if to see it arise and pass, and how we construct an idea of my and you and this world and that world, and see how it's constructed and made, will change our relationship to it. And we realize that things aren't as solid as we thought they were. And there's a lot and there's also a lot more going on moment to moment than we realized. It's very easy when we're preoccupied with something powerful, like some major problem or conflict we have, that's kind of the common stream that runs through our thinking. It keeps recurring over and over again. And it has an impression of being kind of a constant preoccupation. But if you concentrate and look very carefully how the mind functions, see, it's not so constant. It comes and goes, and it breaks up and reappears, and breaks up and reappears. Not only is that true for thoughts, it's also true for emotions. Emotions can have the sense that they're permanent, you know. They're not, you know, I know I'm not going to be sad. You know, someone might think, I'm not going to be sad forever. I know probably tomorrow I'll feel different. But now I'm sad. I'm really sad today. This is like permanent for today. But when the mindfulness is really strong, it has to be strong, you'll see that your emotion is also there for a moment and then passes away. It's there for short periods of time and then it passes away. So I like to do, there were times I've done this driving my car. There's a variety of mindfulness exercises I like to do driving. And one of them is kind of like, I call it emotion meditation, where I just get kind of quiet and I try to see how many different emotions I can have driving down the freeway without trying. And to see how quickly they shift and change. Like I might have a predominant mood that seems to be kind of there, but I say, what else shifts and changes? So the police car pulls up behind me on the freeway. And I feel a little bit of apprehension. And the police car goes away. And then this beautiful, beautiful sports car comes by, you know, with a convertible with red and, you know, I don't know. And so I go, oh, and delight, that's a beautiful car. And then someone cuts me off. And then I get kind of angry. And what's fun about freeway driving is that there's a lot of these. You know, like if you're really tuned in, almost every car that has any kind of close impact to you creates a little kind of emotional response. And you can see how they arise and pass. You know, if the person, you know, has a major cutoff, you almost causes an accident, maybe it stays for a while, the emotion. But a lot of small ones can come ripple through. And you can watch them arise and pass and rise and pass. It's really good to see that. Because if you don't see that, often there's subtle traces or holdings left in the mind from those emotional reactions. And they can build over the course of a day as forms of stress. But if you can be present and watch them, it's more likely that they dissipate. They kind of are complete each time you feel them. And so to start, when the mindfulness becomes really strong, you start seeing through the solidity of even very strong moods, very strong emotional states that we have. And people's identity, people's well-being, people's sense of meaning and purpose and interpretation of life, feeling sorry for yourself, things are terrible, things are wonderful, can often be built on some idea, some strong emotional state that we see as being constant, and we believe is constant. And so we start seeing actually it's not that way. So actually, the mind is actually very fickle, very moves a lot and very quickly. And then there's the perceptions we have of the world. How we perceive the world is also constantly changing. The world maybe doesn't, even if the world didn't change at all, the way that human perception is created, it's made by a lot of small, tiny little moments of perception that we piece together. And we don't necessarily piece it together accurately. It's a construct that we make. And different people will construct their same kind of experience in different ways. I read today in Newsweek that how different people have been raised in different cultures will take in a scene, a scenery, a picture or an event like here, in different ways. Some cultures where they have very strong individualism, autonomy is really important, tend to pick out the details. Cultures that tend to focus more on mutuality, on the cooperative nature of how people fit together in a social structure, tend to look at the gestalt of how the whole picture, the foreground and background situation of how it is. Both of them are looking at the same thing, but both people are constructing it, reconstructing it in different ways. We often think that the way we perceive is accurate. So again, I'll give you another cultural difference. For me, it was a very dramatic moment when I was practicing in the monastery in Japan. And I thought, every morning, we did a very intense period of about 15 minutes of temple cleaning. And it was kind of intense. So all these, mostly the monks were 20, 21 years old guys, you know, full of energy. And we just had to clean wholeheartedly was the practice. It didn't matter if it was already clean, you had to clean. And so like we often would clean, like two or three people would clean the same thing, just so we could all be cleaning. You know, one person would clean, the next person would come along and clean the same thing. And you know, just it was like a ritual cleaning. It was kind of fun. But so we were doing this, you know, we did this every day for months. And then one day I was doing it, and it was kind of like a aha or a wake-up experience. I can't tell you how I understood it, but I saw it. And what I saw was that I was operating in a very different social universe than the Japanese monks were. I was operating as if I was an autonomous individual doing my own thing, distinct from all the other autonomous people who were doing something. And I woke up and said, I saw, that's not how they are. They're living in a different social universe. They see themselves as elements of a unit. The unit, the social unit, the group, was the primary kind of organizing principle, and they were all kind of like appendages to the group. I don't know if I said that accurately or fairly, but I didn't think, when I saw that, it did not occur to me that one way was better than the other. I just thought, wow, there are different ways of constructing identity, the situation, my relationship to other people. And I had never seen so clearly that I was constructing mine my way. I had always assumed that the universe was made for individuals to see themselves as autonomous individual people, not realizing how much that comes from my Norwegian legacy, reinforced by coming to America. And I could see when I had my first son, when he was just a little toddler, I could see that I was at this early, when he was that early, I was already shaping him to be an autonomous individual in ways that you were, you know, normally I wouldn't have noticed that. So what I'm trying to get to is the idea how we perceive the world is very much a part of the mental constructive activity. And perceptions themselves are quite impermanent. They arise and they pass. We don't often see that, but it's possible to see. So another car exercise I've done, mindfulness in the car, is to kind of give up thinking best I can, drive carefully, drive very attentively, be relaxed, and then in the relaxed state, notice, without trying to notice anything, without trying to perceive, notice how many individual moments of perception happen in a second. A second's pretty fast. And when I do that, if then I get locked into thinking, I can feel how that locks me into permanence, into some more preoccupied way of being. And it takes me away from how perceptions are constantly happening very, very fast. How there's many different perceptions every second that are coming in, being registered by the system, and being interpreted and collected together and constructed into this is a road, this is driving, this is a car. And it's fascinating to see how fast the human mind the perception operates. How many of these little perceptions are going on all the time? If you're relaxed about it. Don't try to look for it. Relax and let it show itself to you. Now, I find that I drive more safely when I do this. Because it just, you know, I'm much more aware of all the different things going around me. My attention shifts and it's like a bigger, wider kind of global awareness. So Vipassana practice, when my mindfulness is strong, begins to appreciate or begins to see impermanence at this subtle level, where we see that how many of the core things that build up, that creates the life we live, are constantly in flux. It's a very radical, different way of seeing things. And in order to see it at that level, we have to stop being preoccupied. We have to stop seeing things through our concepts and ideas and interpretations of things, but drop into what we call direct experience, unmediated by concepts. Why do that? One of the reasons why we do that in Buddhism is that when we see that our phenomenological world, the world of experience, is constantly in flux, there's nothing whatsoever that is not in flux, not shifting very rapidly, sooner or later it'll dawn on the mind. The mind will realize that it doesn't make any sense to grab onto any of it because it's not there to grab onto. Because by the time your hand goes out to reach it, it's gone. The very idea that there's something to cling to is itself a kind of delusion. We have an idea that we're clinging, we have an idea there's clinging, we have all these ideas, but and actually drop down to what's really going on experientially, moment by moment, the mind at some point realizes it can't grab on to anything. It can be a little bit disoriented for a while until the mind relaxes around that. And when the mind relaxes around that, then at some point the mind is relaxed enough, it can let go in a very, very deep way. And to be able to let go in this very, very deep way and to realize that it's the safest, happiest form of well-being that you'll ever experience will change your relationship to the world of permanence or the world as we really live it. And you'll probably be much less interested in succumbing to the delusion of permanence again. You realize that that delusion of permanence, holding things as being fixed, is a form of suffering. And to have an experience of radically letting go of holding to anything in the world of impermanence, and to realize how safe, how satisfying, how blissful it is to let go, gives a lot of confidence, gives a lot of strength to our capacity to walk through this life in a wise way. Because then we're not battling against the life so much. We're not struggling. We're not holding on to things. So we see the ordinary impermanence that everybody can see. We see the deeper impermanence moment by moment that arises out of strong vipassana practice. And then at some point, we see that what's sometimes called the transcendental impermanence, where we see the dropping away of our clinging. See that clinging, even the fundamental clinging we have, is also impermanent, can drop away. So this is the answer to Phil's question. I'm sorry I was so long-winded. Usually when you answer questions, you should take less time. Make sure, you know. But so some of you are wondering, is this talk going to be permanent? Going on and on, he's going over time. And so I apologize for going late. And so hopefully that was meaningful. And then I hope you have a wonderful March. And I'll see you again in April.